You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. All right. Time to work the electronic magic known as Skype. That's fantastic. Did you know Skype's got a new edition? Did you care? Yeah. Me neither. Alright, so, standing by for Mr. Nushin. Magical Sky Music.
Yeah, hi, Grant speaking.
Grant Nishim joins us now from the great state of Hawaii. Grant, first of all, Merry Christmas, Happy New Year, or Happy Holidays, whichever you prefer.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. I appreciate all of that.
There you go. First of all, did you do anything exciting for the holidays?
No, I was in Japan for a few days and just got back to Hawaii. But it wasn't really exciting. It was just, I'm lazy by nature, so I enjoy the end of the year and the beginning of the year because you have to do nothing.
Your candor is respected. Now, are you, you tend to be a Baltimore Orioles fan, if I'm not mistaken, yes?
Senators fan. Washington Senators.
Sorry, I knew it was in that area. So the Senators are kind of now the Nationals. Have you migrated your allegiance to either one, the Baltimore team or the Washington team, or are you still stuck with Frank Howard and Ted Williams and the Washington Senators?
And Ed Brankman, the shortstop. But no, the Baltimore thing doesn't transfer for somebody from Northern Virginia. It's like 30 miles, but it might as well be 3,000. I tried and it didn't work. The Nationals, I will become a fan if they win. I'll be bandwagoning on that like anyone. But, yeah, I kind of like them. But, you know, when you're a Senators fan to start with, it does shape your attitude towards life where you think winning 30% of the time is pretty good. You know, if you're
I would think you would be okay with the Nationals. They have the same color uniforms. Okay, they play in the Diplomatic District, and also they win except in the playoffs. So I would think all those would be in your favor in terms of your allegiance, wooing you.
Almost there. I'm not used to being a winner. Maybe that's the problem. The W's the same as well.
So well said. You know, Ed Brinkman had one of the biggest heads ever of a shortstop. He was like, he looked like one of those characters that kind of runs around with the small body and the large head. And the Nationals do it. They have Theodore Roosevelt, they have Lincoln, they have Washington, they have those guys. Ed Brinkman was a human version of that. He had a big head.
I hadn't thought of that. Now that you mention it, they should put another one of those guys to run with George Washington, number 11, in a Senators baseball uniform.
Ed Brinkman. He was the Washington Senators were still a team when my dad got to the big leagues and saw them play on many occasions in Oakland when I was a kid and going to see the Oakland A's play. But the guy who you always remembered is Frank Howard. He was just a monster of a man, signed by the Dodgers, went to the Senators, and he was, I want to say he's about 6'8", and I saw him hit like one of the hardest baseballs I've ever seen. It was just a line drive, and I don't know, they got 20 feet off the ground, and it just smashed into the left field bleachers. And I sat there, I remember watching, oh my God, I've never seen a ball hit like that in my life. He was a massive man. In fact, they have, now they kind of compare Giancarlo Stanton and Aaron Judge to Frank Howard. But there, I don't know if you, but there is no comparison because those two are very, very athletic young men. Frank Howard kind of lumbered. He was a giant of a man, but he was not nearly as athletic as these two guys are, but
I didn't think of the comparison. I see it like you do. Yeah, he was kind of immobile,
right?
But one of those, I forget, like Frank Robinson or one of those great hitters. He said that about Howard, that Howard made the ball get smaller faster than anyone. to refer to his home runs, and they did kind of disappear.
Oh man, he was just a giant. He was a giant of a man. Breaking news from the Korean Peninsula this morning. Evidently, President Moon has asked President Trump to delay military exercises scheduled to take place during the Olympics. The early returns say that the United States will probably accede to that wish. Another olive branch for the North Koreans. What do you make of the spring and the thawing of relations between the Koreans?
Well, we've seen it before, and this is just another version of the Charlie Brown and Lucy with the football trick, where the North holds out and Charlie Brown tries to kick the football, it gets pulled up at the last minute, and he lands on his back. The South Koreans are going to, I think, experience something similar here. But we've got empirical evidence for that, say, going back at least 25 years. There's been other openings, supposedly, on the part of South and North Korea. You'll recall at least two Korean administrations had one a sunshine policy and the other was called something else. And it basically involved giving North Korea a ton of money in exchange for talks and some limited cooperation, allowing some family visits. And that sort of thing. Effectively, for one of these, it was the South Korean administration basically paid about $500 million for what ultimately amounted to a photo opportunity with Kim, with the previous Kim. We've seen it before, but to me at least, one of the significant things is that it shows how within South Korean society and the political world, you have a substantial constituency that does think that they can talk things out with North Korea and somehow reach a deal and resolve all the problems. And there is a subtext, sometimes it's sort of hidden, oftentimes it's not, within this constituency that believes that the United States is the problem. And that's the reason the peninsula is split, because of the Americans. And if the Americans would just cooperate, the Koreans could work things out. And that is one of the troubling parts of all of this, that Moon really does think that. And there's people around him who think it even more. So this sort of thing where the Americans agree to make this concession, and that it tends to create a certain distance or sort of add some friction to the U.S.-South Korean relationship. And ultimately, it works to North Korea's and to China's benefit. But we've seen this before, fortunately, so we have some idea how it's going to turn out. That was probably inevitable that the Americans agree to what the South Koreans asked in this case.
Okay. Having said that, another recent development, and I say recent in the context of our conversation, so since the last time you and I spoke, South Korea seizing, and you explained this to us in terms of when we're talking about sanctions against North Koreans. And first of all, could you explain how shipping transponders and how North Korea still gets goods into port, even though they're quote unquote prohibitions from countries dealing with them? And then I'll follow that with South Korea has begun, at least in two cases, seizing ships that have executed this mission that you'll explain to us. And is that not kind of a back-end embargo? Is that, and what do you make of that? So could you explain how people circumvent the quote-unquote prohibitions of trade? Oh, I knew it was too quiet on the other end. So Grant Newsham was with us, and we lost our signal there. Dun, dun, dun. Dun, 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 dun. I cannot find a way to mute that. I mean, I could do this.
The person whom you're trying to reach is currently unavailable. Please leave a message after the beep.
Really? He's unavailable. All right. I'm not sure what that means. I'm not sure why the call simply ended. Scott, so we'll try again. If I'm nothing else in life, I'm persistent. Not a good sign.
The person whom you're trying to reach is currently unavailable. Please leave a message after the beep.
Newsham, where are you? Goodbye. All right. As is always the case, when you went into this, let me explain something real quick, and hopefully Grant will call back, and then we'll take a quick break. What he explained to us, and he'll come back and do it, but there are third parties that turn off transponders on ships. They make arrangement via landline with the North Koreans and other means of communications. That schedule shipping to arrive on certain dates in certain ports. They take that cargo in at sea. They rendezvous with another ship, and they'll take on their cargo. And then they shut their transponder off, and then they move into those ports. South Korea has started yoking them up. Yeah, yoking them up means you violated the embargo, so we're going to take possession of your ship. So we'll have Grant explain that a little bit, and then ask him, get his thoughts on what's going to happen. So we'll take a quick break. We'll get Grant by either cell phone or some other way. We'll get more of him coming up next here on a Thursday edition of All Marine Radio, right here on the All Warrior Radio Network. Are you looking for the perfect gift for somebody who's in the military? For a first responder? For a hunter? For an outdoorsman? Or somebody that just likes cool military stuff? I've got the perfect gift for you. The Battle Mug. Starts at 10 pounds of aluminum. It's milled, machined, anodized, adorned with Picatinny rails, and then stamped with the serial number, and it's ready for you to make your own. Anything that went on your rifle or pistol can go on your mug. Scope, laser, camera, light. Put a lid on it, and you're ready for the field. If you're inside, add a flag and an emblem, and you're set. Perfect for any commemorative event. Farewell, promotion, retirement, birthday, anniversary, or get out of the doghouse. The Battle Mug is the perfect unique gift. Check out the entire line of product at battlemug.com. Enter the promo code Marine for 15% off. Battle Mug is a veteran-owned and operated company. The product is made entirely in the United States. Check it out, battlemug.com.
All you veterans, listen up. This is Bob Nielsen, former Marine and founder of the 100 Entrepreneurs Project. Turner Construction is looking for veterans with real-world leadership experience to join their team of professionals.
Hold on, Nielsen. Are we talking about a job or a career?
Matt, Turner Construction is a great company with global opportunities for veteran leaders who are looking to start professional careers. I know. I returned to Turner after I got back from Vietnam and retired after 50 years. I had a great career traveling the world leading teams of Turner employees as we built incredible projects.
Are they looking for me to have construction experience, Bob?
Absolutely not. Turner is looking for leaders who have led under pressure. We want leadership. So if you're led in Iraq or Afghanistan or any other contingency, Turner Construction is actively looking for you.
So, a career with competitive pay, good benefits, and a company seeking veteran leaders. That's what we're talking about.
Bingo. We're on the right road when a grunt can understand it. Good job, Mac.
I appreciate that there, Nelson.
How do I get the ball rolling? What do I do?
Just email your resume to jobs@allmarineradio.com, and I will personally contact you and we'll begin the process.
I love it. Turner Construction is looking for veteran leaders who are looking for careers to join their veteran-friendly team. Email Bob Nielsen at jobs@allmarineradio.com. Let's do it.
I'm an individual member. I joined the Global South Foundation because I believe in what it can do, and I also wanted to stay tied to the community that I was part of.
The benefits for individual members of the Global South Foundation are two things. One is networking, keeping in touch with the community, developing new relationships at any stage of your career. And secondly, it helps people stay abreast and up to date on the latest issues that the South community should be aware of.
The Global South Foundation is a great partner of All Marine Radio. Find out more about them at globalsouthfoundation.org/Marines.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
All I can say about MilitaryByOwner.com is, wow, I listed my house on your website for only 2 weeks in a tough rental market, and now my house is about to get rented. I will definitely recommend you guys to everyone in the military. Thank you.
Are you located near a military base? Advertise with Military by Owner for optimum exposure to the military community. Military by Owner has experience helping military families find, sell, or rent their home near a military base for the past 15 years. MilitaryByOwner.com, proven and dependable.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Okay, no music, no screwing around, okay? Grant Newsham rejoins us just by the wonder of cell phone, which we don't often get to do, but it's a pleasant change. Grant, good to see you well, and nothing nefarious. Do you think that, I just got an email, Matt, do you think the North Koreans sabotaged the Skype line? Well, I don't know. There's a lot of that going on.
Who knows? It's nothing would surprise me. I found with Skype it does happen now and then, but these guys are pretty active, and Chinese as well. So I wouldn't rule it out, but Skype often does seem a little bit like the orange juice cans and some string connection, so I've seen that happen.
All right. Works often, but not always. Okay, let me lay out a question for you. You explained to us months ago how the North Koreans have historically got around sanctions, that ships will go to sea, they'll either underweigh transfer either cargo or oil from other ships, they'll turn off their transponders based on prearranged times and whatnot, they'll go into North Korean ports and offload that stuff and then go back out to sea. Is that an accurate assessment of it? Could you explain that if it's not? And then recently the South Koreans have seized at least two transport vessels, cargo vessels, I'm not sure, I think one was oil and one was cargo, that have made visits to North Korean ports, and they've seized those, which is kind of a back-end blockade. We're not going to blockade you going in, because that might be an act of war, but we're going to take possession of your ship on the way out. I'm curious about your thoughts on that. So explain getting around it, and then give me an opinion based on what you see relative to South Korea's taking possession of these ships and any thoughts on how North Korea will react.
Okay, well, first, I think you've accurately described the way that you can move oil and really move anything you want. You just need a ship or ship owners or a ship company that cooperates with you and then get out somewhere and, as you said, turn off the transponder. It's not as if there's this giant satellite watching every ship on the ocean that knows exactly where it is if the ship isn't cooperating. So once you can kind of make yourself invisible so you can't be found without a whole lot of trouble if you go out there, and that's what they do. The Russians have been doing this forever. There's been this constant sort of coastal trade between that port, the closest Russian port, and North Korea. It's been going on forever with smuggling of every sort, and the Russians are brazen about it. So for them, this is just standard practice. The Chinese have been doing it just as long as well. And you also note it doesn't take much. You just need a few shiploads to make a huge difference in a country like North Korea. So this is no surprise. And also there's obviously third party or third nation cutouts that get used for this. Apparently, I think Taiwan has been involved in this fairly substantially. And it does say ships out and registered in Hong Kong and Singapore as well. So it's not, they do manage to disguise it so that it takes some effort to find, but it's not impossible if one makes the effort. As for why the South Koreans suddenly decided to make something of it and seize those two ships, but that's probably our influence more than anything else. And also, you do have in South Korea, you do have still, although I've characterized a sizable chunk of the constituency of the population as pro-North Korea and somewhat anti-American, that there are still an equally sizable constituency that sees things more sensibly and does see the North Koreans as a threat and doesn't like being bullied by China. So the Americans have a receptive audience there. It's not as if the entire South Korean government is subverted. So the American intelligence, should be much better than it is, but they are good at some things, and keeping track of ships in cases like this, where they did, as Mr. Trump said, catch them red-handed, that once they had that information, I think they found some South Koreans who were willing to make an issue of this. So sort of simultaneously you have South Korean appeasement going on with a more sensible, stricter approach towards North Korea. So they just happen to use these as examples to try to embarrass China as much as anything else. But the test will be if this just dies away, or if the Americans keep providing more and more evidence and the South Koreans keep releasing it as well. So the test will be to watch what happens in coming weeks. If this continues. But if it was just a one-time thing, then I wouldn't expect it really to change much.
All right. So, but there's no reason, for instance, the same technology that allowed us to track these ships and whatnot, there's nothing that is transitory about that technology that will, anybody who makes a port visit to that, I'm sure is being traced. Their whereabouts and what's going on in the sea lanes adjacent to the Koreas is I'm sure being monitored by our little gremlins that monitor such things, and so that information isn't going anywhere. It's simply the Koreans' desire to and I've got an email that's kind of interesting. It's simply the Koreans' desire for the moon to actually be made of green cheese. Their will, if you will?
Somewhat. I would suggest it's also the Americans' desire to see that as well, because it's been successive administrations which have refused to publicize or reveal clear evidence of Chinese violating sanctions, the Russians as well. The Americans does have decent intelligence. They just have refused to use it because it would embarrass or it would provoke the Chinese or the Russians. So we've actually got a couple aces to play. We've just chosen never to play them. This is about one of the rare times that an administration in memory has actually done something like this. And it's the thing, the fact that this is even something we're talking about, I think tells you just how much that the policy towards the North Korea problem, towards China, has really been inept. for a good long while, and based on this desire that the world is not how it is, but it's in some imaginary way that people would like it to be.
The here's the email. Mac, I'm curious about something Grant said a few minutes ago about American administrations who choose not to reveal the truth to the American people. This, to me, is part of a very disturbing ongoing trend that we see in the FBI, the Justice Department. You read a very, very interesting story this morning, and then in parentheses he writes, albeit an opinion piece, about, quote-unquote, making Iran great again. And it's this disconnect between intellectuals and liberals who view the world as they want to view it, as opposed to the way it truly is. I'm curious Grant's thoughts about how you deal with nations such as Russia, China, Iran, North Korea, when you have people like this in power that won't allow the truth to see the light of day because it will embarrass their policies and embarrass them as politicians. How do we get to ground truth? How do we do the right thing? Grant, I guess you can't if you have people like that in power that won't tell the truth about the things that are, they know that are blatantly going on, that they see in briefs every morning. This ship came from here. It delivered this amount of oil to North Korea. This ship came from there. It delivered these goods to North Korea. It rendezvoused here. All that stuff that you know, that we all know, that we gather, when that can't see the light of day and our foreign policy isn't based on that, how does any of this change?
Well, that's a good question, and it's pretty easy to be, I think, depressed about it all. But I think that, and I imagine the ancient Greeks probably knew the problem just as well as we do, but it's the emailer certainly correctly identifies a problem. I tend to see it more of a symptom or a manifestation of a fundamental, in the recent case, a fundamental sort of desire to appease. Of course, the people doing the appeasing will not use that word because it's a dirty word, but it's the same thing. It's the idea that if you just understand your adversaries or your enemies and don't embarrass them, don't cause them to lose face, then they will gradually over time become nicer, or you can work something out with them, but you mustn't provoke. You have to de-escalate. And revealing this sort of wrongdoing is just, to these people, by definition, it's unthinkable because it will irritate, will bother the adversary. And they're only adversaries, it's often thought, because of something we've done. You know, whether overthrowing Mossadegh in Iran many years ago. You still hear that trotted out all the time. We've done something or other to the North Koreans. It's really our fault for sort of ostracizing them and putting sanctions on them. And some American scholars even claim it was our heavy bombing of them during the Korean War that has caused the problem. So this part of that is this idea that somehow America's to blame, that you can always work something out diplomatically or by talking, if you're just nice to people, that I think that is what leads to these ideas that leads to things like just sitting on good intelligence of wrongdoing that needs to be exposed. And I would, in fairness, when the George Bush administration wasn't much better towards North Korea or towards China, and particularly when it came to the issue of Taiwan. So it's a sort of a bipartisan accomplishment, I think one would say, to get us into the fix we're in today. But you're at least, you know, an optimist, and it's still early in the morning, might suggest that the fact that this has even been revealed is useful. The fact Mr. Trump actually got out and made some favorable references to Iranian demonstrators, as opposed to 2009 when Mr. Obama stayed mute and effectively supported the Iranian regime thinking that that display of magnanimity on the American part would get the Iranians to see us as friends and then everything would work out. Well, that didn't work. One is right to be sort of skeptical of all of this and really to wonder why we don't just act smarter for some reason, do some commonsensical things, which anybody who doesn't have an Ivy League PhD could probably tell you is a good idea. But sometimes circumstances cause even America to reach a point where it can't avoid these situations, and I think we're getting to that point. And you will notice that compared to, say, even 3 or 5 years ago, you're hearing more adversarial commentary about America's adversaries, particularly China. China in particular, I would say, and even North Korea. You are starting to hear more of that from the people who traditionally have been a part of the peace at any price appeasement crowd. And even from U.S. industry, you're starting to hear more discontent, sort of a recognition that American businesses trying to do business in China have been getting cheated for a good long while. And finally, you're starting to see that. But it often takes a disaster or some really difficult situation to wake us up, it seems.
Grant Newsham, my guest, retired Marine Corps colonel. You mentioned Iran in your answer, and so I want to read to you a little piece of something that I saw in the Wall Street Journal today, and it's written by a guy named Daniel Henninger, and the title is "Make Iran Great Again," and he started watching, obviously observing the late last week, the demonstrations in Iran, and he went to see a movie called Darkest Hour about Winston Churchill, and so he goes to see that. There comes on a trailer for a movie that features Barack Obama and his foreign policy making, Susan Rice, John Kerry, yada yada yada, called The Final Year. So he's reflecting on this kind of kaleidoscope as he watches the movie, and he has a couple interesting things to say. But one of the things he says in the movie that he quotes Churchill as saying, screaming, evidently, and pounding his fist on the table, which I'm sure, or may or may not have been theatrics relative to maybe Churchill actually delivered the line like that. But Churchill supposedly said, "You cannot negotiate with dictators," reflecting on the 1930s and Europe's, appeasement of Germany. And I don't want to and so it's almost like there's this lesson here that is redundant in history that we are continuing to learn, that the only true peace you can have is peace through strength. And when you decide to unilaterally disarm yourself, you will then be subject to dictators who are bullies. And so I want to read you a couple of sentences here. From this opinion piece in the Wall Street Journal. "Come to think of it, isn't the disconnect between the people running governments and the people trying to make a living in the real economy the core reason behind the worldwide burst of populism? Isn't the reason France's working class voters and young, underemployed college graduates sent Emmanuel Macron and a heretofore non-existent party into the French presidency? Isn't the reason working class Brits lunged for Brexit? Isn't this new global reality, perform or get shoved aside, the reason Saudi Arabia's Prince Mohammed bin Salman imposed reform?" And then he ends with this: "The moment has arrived to admit Iran's missiles, nuclear technology, and armies won't stay inside its borders until the people getting shot in the streets are recognized and supported by a too timid world." So I think what we're discussing is a too timid world. And the other email that I got, and let me weave that in here, and then I'll hand it to you, is this. Mac, it seems like we will do anything that North Korea asks if it makes them happy and quote-unquote opens a door. I think they could ask us to send every stripper in the United States to North Korea, and we would entertain that as a serious diplomatic overture that would open some kind of door to some kind of negotiated settlement with the North Koreans. I find it exasperating that we do this dance over and over and over. The only thing that he will ultimately understand is the strength of South Korea, the United States, Japan, and Australia in the Western Pacific. That's the only thing that dictators ever understand. It's interesting, the dictators in Iran, I'm sure, are getting quite nervous because of the way those protests spread. I saw a map today that compared 2009 with today. It is astounding. The spread of these demonstrations across Iran is something that never happened in 2009 and is a sure sign that there is something wrong deeply in that country. I'm curious about Grant's thoughts. Newsham, to you.
Okay, well, here's a few ideas. I saw the movie Darkest Hour as well. My daughter took me to it, actually. Wow. When she was there with me, it brought the average age in the theater down to about 61. but nice. it's an excellent movie.
You'd recommend it?
Oh, go ahead. Oh, yeah, it's very good. And particularly, there's something really contemporary about it. In the sense that the difficulties Mr. Churchill faced, the fix the world had, the free world had gotten itself into through its own malfeasance, it just seems very familiar, particularly for someone who follows China a lot. And it really is very well done. But I say there's that contemporary aspect to it, and you'll find that the people who've been warning about China for 15, 20 years or longer, were ridiculed and were treated much the way that Mr. Churchill and sort of his people were. And, you know, one wonders if we have time. You know, I do wonder that because I think in some respects the threat from China in current situation does resemble 1938. And I think, though, that in some respects that the PRC poses a bigger threat to the U.S. than Nazi Germany ever did. As for the sort of the rise of populism, I agree with what was written, what was said, and I've noticed that, you know, there's a sort of a crowd that runs things, and certainly in the United States, and you know, I focus a lot on foreign affairs,
right.
But even in sort of domestic matters too, and you see it in other consensual governments. It's generally a very well-educated, at least credentialed crowd. You know,
right.
They've been to all the right schools, they have the right degrees, they all go to the right conferences. And there's very much a sense that, well, we know better. We know what's good for people. And the extent to which these people have no idea what anyone outside of their group thinks or experiences in their daily lives is really striking. And the others have said this as well, but I think that is a reflection on why Mr. Trump, his appeal had such wide appeal in these parts of the United States or parts of the United Kingdom, parts of France, that Austria even, that ruling class, for want of a better word, or that pedigreed credentialed class, they have no idea what these people are like, what they think, or what they go through. And so this reaction is not surprising. I think it's actually a good thing. But very much is, if you hang around what I would call the Ivy League PhD class, that East Coast corridor from D.C. up to Boston that pretty much runs foreign affairs, there is very much a sense they are the only ones who know anything, the only ones who deserve to comment or be listened to. And that's despite, you know, we're doing the financial world's equivalent of having gotten the client a return on investment of about 0.00001%. In other words, having failed miserably. But you know, there's certainly an incestuousness in that strata of our ruling class, which is not healthy, and we've seen a reaction to that. As for North Korea and our sort of willingness to do anything they ask, it's not quite as bad as it was, I think, during the Obama and the Bush administrations, where there was this belief really championed by a diplomat named Christopher Hill, that all that we could work something out, that he was smooth-tongued enough that and made such good friends of the North Korean counterparts that they could work something out as long as these war hawks didn't threaten the North Koreans and just kept things calm. Well, that did, hasn't worked very well at all. I would note that there's one aspect of what's going on today, and has over the years, is that you do have to consider the South Koreans in all of this. And there is a limit to how much the Americans can require them to do or insist they do or get them to do. And I think a lot of what we're seeing most recently is a reaction to the Moon administration and the Trump administration trying to figure out a way to keep Moon on board while not giving away the game to North Korea. There are people within the Trump administration who really do have a good understanding of what needs done with North Korea and the rest of Asia as well. But there's constant tension within this administration, like any, between people who think very differently. I think, though, that one sort of test of how serious we are about North Korea is the extent to which the United States goes about closing down, revealing and closing down North Korea's licit and illicit money-making operations throughout the world. This is a very easy thing to do, both to uncover them and then do something about it. And any competent intelligence service and any serious administration that wanted to do it could get it done. And I think that is something to pay attention to. Going on to Iran, one hopes, at least one would like to see that the protesters, the demonstrators get what they want. There is in the chattering class or the commentariat, there is a belief that, if they want to change things, it's up to them. They'll have to do it. The Iranian regime has got immense coercive capabilities. They've got Revolutionary Guards, they've got the militia, they've got very good technology for controlling IT systems, controlling the internet, which they used very effectively in 2009. A lot of it provided by Ericsson of Sweden, that doesn't like to admit that. And they've got a pretty good ability to crack down and a willingness to use it. So I'm sort of a skeptic. I would like the current protest to go further, but I wonder if they might not just get suppressed just through the sheer force of violence, in fairly short order. But it would be nice to see an American administration actually stand up to Iran, and that's one of the reasons why I can, and you do see the sort of the benefits of that, and to the extent you can cause discomfort in that country and with the ruling class, that you loosen their hold on power. That's one of the reasons why I consider that the Iran nuclear deal to be such a just craven appeasement of the worst sort. And I think something that will be paid for by effectively bankrolling the Iranian regime and really just at most delaying their development of nuclear weapons by really just a matter of months, probably. Watch the movie Darkest Hour, apply it to Iran, and you might feel similarly as I did when you look at it with China. But I think with Iran, it would be nice, but there has been this sense that, there's really nothing America can do, and somehow we can make friends with these so-called moderate Iranians, which are sort of simply a snipe hunt, or they don't exist, and they never have. But successive American administrations have fallen for this trap. One period where there was some, and I think it was instructive, where it was, we did actually do pretty well, was in 2003, after the invasion of Iraq. There was a several-month period when the Iranians became really cooperative really fast. And they show because they were scared as to what we might do. But we have traditionally not taken a very strict approach towards Iran, and I think we could do better than that. Just a few comments on several topics.
No, I find the Iranian issue extremely interesting. And give me you made your living in the intelligence world, and so I mean you know more than most. But you know, Iran is described as a West leaning nation, in that people that go there say that the people, the Iranian people, they have great interest in and they love the United States. But the leadership of the nation has a completely separate agenda. I'm curious your thoughts on that.
I think that's basically accurate. The Persian civilization really is an impressive one, particularly when you look at, and it's distinct from the Arab civilization. It's distinct from what you find if you go farther east. That it really is an impressive one. If you look at it, sort of the history of it and the details of it, and we tend to lump them in with sort of the nutty parts of the Arab world. But I think that is wrong. That there are, we have, our image has indeed been shaped by Ayatollah Khomeini back when he came along in the late 70s. And there's mobs of people chanting death to the Shah, death to America, etc. That tends to shape our image, but it is a very different country, actually, if it's allowed to, allowed to flourish, or if you can get the repressive hand of the mullahs, remove that. And I think you'd find a pretty impressive country, actually. Like any country, it's complex, but I think that the approach towards Iran has been, in some respect, shaped by this crazy belief that there is no alternative to the mullahs, to this corrupt religious clique that runs the place, and that somehow Iranian people don't even deserve anything better because that's what they are, that's what they deserve. But I think that's been the wrong approach, and we should have done everything we could to sort of undermine and get rid of that regime to the extent, to a reasonable extent. But we could have done a lot more than try to appease them, doing things like send them Bibles and cakes shaped like keys, if anyone remembers that reference, which is what the Reagan administration tried to do. But it has been a snipe hunt for these alleged Iranian moderates in the regime that we're going to somehow work things out with. But Iran and Persia is, the people really talk of it as potentially being a real useful player in sort of that part of the world. I think that is not far-fetched at all. It's just how you get there. But it's always worth remembering that Iran is capable of a lot more than these guys in shouting death to America, and really just an incredibly corrupt ruling class or ruling clique, and it pervades the country. It would have been nice if we could have kept the sanctions going instead of doing what John Kerry and Mr. Obama and et cetera did to relax things, because they were having a serious effect. But Persia could be a lot more than that image of chanting mobs, though most people don't tend to recognize that. And, really, it's, I remember it from about the late 70s. But I remember a bit of it before that, during the Shah's era.
Yeah, they were stable ally, right, Grant? I mean, and I was talking earlier today about when the fall of the disintegration of the Soviet Union, and I think you were, when you watch that, and we all grew up with it, right? The Red Menace, since they didn't go home in World War II and built walls, we all grew up with that. And then all of a sudden, the day came when they were no longer, that they had shrunk back within their borders, and you had these free sovereign nations. So what was a world like where you didn't have this red menace around the globe? And so to me, I had somewhat of a similar kind of epiphany, theoretical epiphany, thinking about what is the Middle East like without Iranian destabilization in the region? And you think, wow, what would that be like? And
yeah,
so
you do. Yeah.
Go ahead. Your thoughts.
Yeah, you're quite right. If the Iranian regime did not exist, we'd have probably seen about 90% less terrorism around the world than we have over the last 40 years. It has been that much of an instigator. And even with Al-Qaeda as well, the support it's provided for them. But it really is an odious regime by any respect. And one often hears, though, from the, some commentators, well, it's the Shah was worse, which I think that is very much a debatable point. But the argument is somehow that there's no option besides extremism on one side, and that seems one can even characterize the Shah that way. But rather that somehow Persia, Iran is not entitled or not capable of anything better. And yet it is, and yet we have not supported that sort of that option. It doesn't help, but it's understandable that a good chunk of the people who could have brought it about live in Los Angeles or D.C. Instead of Iran. But nonetheless, there's been a lack of imagination as to what Iran and Persia are capable of. But the support for sort of terrorism and just destabilization that Iran has caused has just been immense, and it's been really a feature of most of my adult life, actually, to the point that the word Iran just conjures up an image the way the old, the word Soviet Union or Russia used to, as you said, before the wall fell. And now they're trying to do it again, but it's not quite at that level.
Right. The final question, I will let you go. Grant Newsham again this morning with us. So, the Prime Minister of Japan, I believe within the last 24, 48 hours, said that North Korea poses the greatest threat to Japan since World War II. What has changed in Japan, if anything? Is that statement leading to any nuclearization of Japan? Can you bring us up to snuff on what that statement means and if there's a deeper purpose there?
I think Mr. Abe, the Prime Minister, has said he said the same thing in recent times, a few times. I think he's trying to sort of fire up the population or to really set the domestic conditions to make sure that there is a sense of just how serious this is. And he's trying to undercut opposition, I think, to his efforts to sort of upgrade or improve Japan's defense capabilities. And perhaps he's also trying to work into this the support for his changing or revising the constitution, which he really wants to do.
Right.
So I think there's a domestic angle to this. But it's always better than hearing the alternative. But I think that Japan, as has been the case, I think I've mentioned this before, that until it increases defense spending a lot and spends it properly, that it's really not serious. There may be some good intention people, but speaking it as a country, until you spend money, you're not serious, and it is still not proven willing to do that. The latest defense budget proposals don't really increase spending very much at all. So it's like when Mr. Reagan came into office, if anyone remembers that, he had a lot of good ideas for improving and fixing America's military. But if he hadn't increased defense spending, nothing much would have changed. And that ultimately is the situation with Japan, that until they really increase, put the money on the table, that ultimately they're not serious. You can see why I never get invited to much, to the official gatherings. but that nobody wants to hear it, but I just don't see any other way to look at it.
Well, no, it's impolite to pull people's pants down in public.
Oh, or even just in, you know, I don't have to pull it down. They've got to, they've already taken it down.
Well,
but you're not allowed to say that.
No, no, you can't, you can't say it. Somebody might get offended.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Grant, first of all, thank you very much for the visit. And as always,
thank
we
you.
Appreciate your insight, not only on things in the Western Pacific, but also in Iran. I think, to me, Iran is a very interesting country. And what's going on there is much different today than in 2009. If you look at where and how these protests started. And so it'll be very interesting to watch. But have a great week. Thank you for the visit.
Okay, thanks very much. Talk to you later.
All right. That is Grant Newsham here on always a great guest for us, and love having him on. So we'll take a quick break. Michael Musselman will join us as we continue on a Thursday edition of All Marine Radio right here on your home for it, and that is the one and only All Warrior Radio Network.